Good morning. I'm so glad to see none of the adults were standing on their chairs now, because that pack is to keep you busy while I'm preaching. So thanks for just the kids standing. So it's good to have you if you're visiting with us this morning. It's good to have you. Yeah, we've been preaching through the book of Ruth, a series on Ruth, and I know this weekend is Easter, and but I want to start in Ruth, because something for me just came alive there, and then from there we're going to work our way through to Isaiah. But the book of Ruth is this incredible story of a famine in the land, and then there's this woman called Naomi and her family that moves to Moab, and in the moving to Moab, her husband dies. Her two sons then marry, Ruth and Orpah. I'll go with Orpah, I know it's Orpah, but just to make it fun. And then her two sons die. So husband dies, two sons die. And then she hears in Moab that the Lord has come to the aid of the people. All of a sudden there's food, so they're making their way back to Bethlehem. And in making their way back, there's this conversation that Naomi has with her two daughters-in-law. She says, but Naomi said in verse 11 of Ruth 1, but Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, which paraphrased is, there is no hope for me. Even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait? Would you wait until they grow up? Would you remain unmarried for them? The way she's questioning is like, I wouldn't wait. I'm just telling you, like, in terms of what I see in front of me, I would not wait. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me. It is like a horrible story of bitterness and tragedy. And so we've got the benefit of knowing the story. We've read the book of Ruth, most of us. For those of you that haven't, it ends well. Chapter 4, redemptive outcome. In between chapter 1 and chapter 4, in walks Boaz, this man of standing, and he turns things around. He redeems the situation. He buys the property back. He marries Ruth, the one daughter-in-law, and God opens up her womb, and she conceives, and there's a little boy that gets born, Obed. And the chapter 4 ends with Naomi being totally redeemed. So in chapter 1, it's tragic stories. Chapter 4, total redemption. She's found her way back into family. All of her possessions has been redeemed back to her. And there she is with Obed in her arms, her little grandson. So like we said 2 weeks ago, she went from Mara to Grandmara in 4 chapters. And it was beautiful. But I want us to just focus on Naomi. Because sometimes I think we get the big story, and while we're reading the story of Naomi in chapter 1, we're already in chapter 4 in our minds. We're kind of like, hey, I know this is going to end well. Like, just hold tight, Naomi. It's gonna end well. Like, the redemption's coming. But if we had to, just for now, just try and find our way into Naomi's shoes and say, well, we don't know what's happening in chapter 2, 3, and 4. We just know about chapter 1. We're Naomi, and we're in Naomi's shoes, and we are facing this very bitter circumstance, where she says, call me Mara. And the reason why I think she does is because she only has evidence of her circumstance. We've said plenty of times in this series, it's like amazing how God was orchestrating things, but it's like he works behind the scenes. You know, like there's very few times where it speaks about the Lord directly, but he's working behind the scenes, and he's orchestrating things. He's making things happen. And that's the beauty of it. We get encouraged by that. We go like, yes, Lord, you're behind the scenes. You're just making things happen, and you're turning this for your redemptive purpose, and it's brilliant. But for Naomi, she doesn't have that evidence. She doesn't see what's happening behind the scenes. She's stuck in her chapter 1. The only evidence that she does have is that she's lost her husband. Her husband has died, and her two sons have died, and there's tragedy in chapter 1. That's all she has. And I can imagine the community trying to encourage her, coming with words of encouragement. It's like, hey, Naomi, like, don't forget about the Exodus. Remember, we celebrate it every year, Passover. If she had come back in the week of Passover, like we're celebrating Easter, I don't know if she would have said anything different. She would have still been saying, call me Mara. It's like, I get the fact that, you know, there's all these things to celebrate. I get the fact that God is faithful. I hear that he is trustworthy. And I hear that you're like kind of hope, absolutely. But seriously, right now, I have lost my husband. I have lost my sons. I have lost everything. All of my possession is gone. And you could have a lady coming up to her, one of the people, just to try and encourage her with a reading. And it's like, Naomi, this morning, I read in the law of Moses, Deuteronomy 4:31. Listen to this. For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not abandon or destroy you or forget the covenant with your ancestors. Love the encouraging words of the brethren. But in that moment, I think Naomi was saying, thanks for that. And I know it. I've read that as well. I'm on the same reading plan. I got that this morning. But as much as I know it, I don't sense it. Because I feel forgotten. I feel forsaken. What do we say to Naomi? Fast bait. Hang in there. Chapter 4 is coming. But actually, no, she's in her chapter 1. And I was listening to this preach on Isaiah 49, and it came through for me so strongly that I realized that this is not a Naomi thing exclusively. It's a condition of the heart. It came through so clearly for me because in Isaiah 49, it's these incredibly powerful, sweeping promises of salvation from verse 1 through to verse 13 in Isaiah 49. So in verse 5, it says, and now the Lord says, he who formed me in the womb to be his servant, this is speaking about Jesus, the servant of the Lord, to bring Jacob back to him and gather Israel to himself. So now we're speaking about salvation of the Jews. The Israelite nation is going to be saved. For I am honored in the eyes of the Lord, and my God has been my strength. Verse 6, he says, it is too small a thing for you to be my servant, to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. And here we see salvation to the Gentiles and to the ends of the earth. And then in verse 13, shout for joy, you heavens. Rejoice, you earth. Burst into song, you mountains. For the Lord comforts his people and will have compassion on all his afflicted ones. The new heavens and the new earth. So the context for the people that's reading this, as the prophecy of Isaiah comes to them, is historically we know God has come through for us. He's delivered us. We celebrate it every year. There's this historic reality to salvation. Now we're hearing about a salvation to come, and it's imminent. It's right there in front of us. It's to the Jews. It's to the Gentiles, to the nations. And then there's this ultimate salvation, a new heaven and a new earth where everything will be perfect, and we'll be with him. Sweeping, panoramic promise of redemption. Chapter 4 is coming. And chapter 4 leads into Matthew 1, the genealogy of Jesus. Whoa! But then verse 14 says this, but Zion said, the Lord has forsaken me. The Lord has forgotten me. Now Zion was the word that was used to describe Israel. That was the hill where the temple was built. And it was used as a description of the Israelite nation. The Israelite nation, they've just heard the sweeping prophecy and promise of redemption and salvation. Verse 1 to verse 13. But then they say, the Lord has forsaken me. The Lord's forgotten me. You see, what they're saying in that moment is exactly what Naomi was saying. Yes, I get salvation historically. I get salvation imminently. I get salvation ultimately. But actually, my problem's right now. I'm facing a now situation. And right now, I feel forsaken. Right now, I feel forgotten. Lord, the temple is our assurance that you are with us and you for us. Have you seen the temple? It's in ruins. I feel forsaken now. And this condition of the heart comes through in the nation of Israel, not just a single lady facing tragedy in the book of Ruth, but the nation of Israel saying the exact same thing. Because what they're saying is, we believe in you, God. Kind of like this mental subscription to doctrine. But as far as what we're feeling, what we're sensing, is we feel forsaken, we feel forgotten. That reality that we can sing about and we celebrate, and the wonder of God and the power of God and His salvation to us can come at us, but somehow the circumstances of life come at us even stronger. And we're weighing the evidence of those two things up, and we find ourselves wanting, where we say, gee, I don't know if God has remembered me. Have you seen my business? Have you seen my finances? Have you seen the trouble that I'm in? Have you seen the tragedy that I'm facing? The evidence is stacked up against me. Have you seen the thoughts that are in my mind? Have you seen my attitudes? Have you seen the sin in my life? It's like, I hear it, but I'm not really sure. I don't sense it. And there's this dissonance between what we believe, but how it plays out in our lives. Somehow there's like two different things. And you might say, no, well, that's not true for me. You might be speaking to a couple of people, yeah. But for me, there's no gap. The issue is, this thing shows itself when trouble comes. When you face a trial, when difficulty hits you, that's when it's really tested. And when people are going through tough times, be careful with your words. Don't suck it up. That's not helpful. They're in their chapter one. There's a now. And yes, we can encourage them with the chapter four reality of redemption. Say, Naomi, don't worry, it's coming, it's coming. But actually, they're still in it. They're facing their reality now. And I wonder how much of our lives represent something of a, yes, I believe in God. Yes, I believe in Jesus. I've put my faith in Him. I'm saved. I can come on a Sunday. Yes, I can praise Him. But it's like I'm like really working hard, yeah? Because I know tomorrow I'm going to work and I'm facing that reality. Or I'm going back home to a difficult marriage, or I'm going back home with all my insecurities and all my bitterness and all my offense, and somehow there's this gap. But I think God has something special for us. I don't think that God wants there to be a gap. It's like there's a reality of circumstance, there's a reality of tragedy and all those things that can happen to us where we face difficulty. But I don't think God wants us to have a gap. Last week we said goodbye to a couple, Madhava and Petri. And when they stood up, I was reminded of a story of a time when a family came and saw me here about funeral arrangements for the husband who had died. So the wife was there and the kids were there, and they were a bit older, like high school, kind of beyond school age. And while we were talking, I kind of thought, yes, you look familiar, but I'm not 100% sure. So I asked them, are you guys in 3CR? And there was this like sheepish answer, like, yeah, kind of. So, well, what's the story? Well, actually, we didn't really want to come. It was our dad that wanted to come. Because we started a building renovation. And soon after starting that building renovation, we found out that my dad's got cancer, that he was diagnosed with cancer, and he was given a couple of weeks, short period of time. But you know, there was this man that came, and he was the building contractor. His name was Madhava. And he shared the gospel. I can't remember exactly how they put it. They had their own words to describe it. But something happened with my dad, and I chatted with Madhava, and I understood that that's what took place. This man got saved in his moment of absolute pain and weakness and facing death. And the thing that I then remembered was that I always got to see the back of this family, because often I would stand at the back and I would look from the back to the front and see them standing right at the back, worshiping God. And there was this awkward stance of the mom and the kids, but the dad, he was popping. Like when you grow in church, you learn certain styles of worship, you know? Nando's chicken wing, blind guide. There was nothing conventional about this. He looked like a hippie at a music festival. He was all over the place. And I thought, Lord, how does a man that's facing that, imminent death, I'm going to leave my wife and my kids behind. The sobering reality of death is right in front of me. Is my family going to be okay? Is my wife going to manage this? But somehow, he would come here on a Sunday and put us all to shame as he would worship God, because there was something in his heart that rose up within him, because he had a faith that would surmount those circumstances. And when I see something like that, I know God doesn't want us to live with the reality of our tragedies and our circumstances keeping us down, where it would darken the reality of what God has done for us. I don't know where I am now. My notes are all over the place. So how does God deal with this despondency? He doesn't say, suck it up. He doesn't say, hey, get over yourself. Pull yourself towards yourself. He doesn't bring those harsh words. This is what he says. So verse 14 says this, but Zion said, the Lord has forsaken me, the Lord has forgotten me. Verse 15 says, this is God responding to that. He says this, can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion on the child she has born? Though she may forget, I will not forget you. Verse 16, see, I have engraved you on the palm of my hands. Your walls are ever before me. That's speaking about the walls of the city of Zion. You ever before me. Your life, ever before me. And I've engraved you in the palms of my hands. And I love how God doesn't tell us to suck it up. He comes with this incredibly beautiful truth that he puts in this amazing theological metaphor, where he says, think of a mother nursing an infant. My love for you is like that. Can a mother forget? Have you seen a mother nursing a baby? I've seen it 3 times, closely. And there's at least 3 things that I can think of. Because what happens when a mother's nursing a baby, there's reasons why she cannot forget. And the first one's physically. She cannot forget. Before she's even thought about anything, before any heart emotion has played out, physically she can't forget. Because when you nurse a baby, and I might have a few doctors in the room, Pete, help me if I get it wrong, but stuff gets released, like hormones get released, prolactins or something. Is it right? Absolutely. Which means that when you feed, when you nurse, behind all of that, hormones are being released that's producing more milk, which means you need to feed more. Because if you don't, things get uncomfortable. You don't need an alarm. You don't need a reminder. You don't even need the baby to cry. Physically, you just move towards the baby. Otherwise, it gets uncomfortable. Prolactins. But not only is it physically a reality that a mother cannot forget a baby when she's nursing her baby, but emotionally, I'm going to potentially forget this one, oxytocins, something like that. There's another thing that gets released. That's your emotional vibe. Like everything inside of you, as you nurse a baby, as you interact with that baby, there are things being released within you that grows your emotional bond with that child. I've seen my wife, like baby sleeping, and she's standing there staring at it. You know, that thing that gets released, that grows the bond within, it actually, it's most significant when you see the baby. It's like the physiological reality of it. And I'd be like, babe, what? You just complained that you are so tired. Here's a tip. Baby sleeping, that means you could sleep right now. I mean, it's like, that's your perfect time right there. She's like, no, I'm just going to. I'm like, what the heck? I just want to, just going to look. They're sleeping. I know. And you can have your child being babysat by the in-laws or whatever, and you go watch a movie, but you can see your wife's kind of like, okay, let's go. She runs into the house. Because that bond, the emotional reality of what's happening between a nursing mother and a baby is so real that it moves her towards the baby. And you know that the love of a mother is not just physical and emotional, it's also unconditional. Most relationships require give and take. There's a mutuality to it, otherwise it just falls flat. But with this relationship, the mothers all give. The babies all take. And despite the fact that it's all take, the mother keeps loving, and she keeps loving, and she keeps loving. You give nothing back to me, but I will continue to love you. And then God says, compare that to me. Compare it to me. And there's a second half to it where he says, though she may forget, I will never forget. The original text actually says, she will forget. He was like, oh, not my mother. Well, you can look at your wife and say, oh, no, you haven't seen my wife. She would never forget. But the reality is we all get old, and a mother will get old, and she'll go senile, and then she'll die. Relax, it's Easter, not Mother's Day. Eventually, you will lose your mother. So the reality is there's this indestructible quality in a mother. Indestructible. I love you. Physically, there are forces within me that moves me towards you. Emotionally, there are profound realities happening inside you that I cannot help myself, but I move towards you. Unconditionally. It's like, how sacrificial, how unconditional, how indestructible is the love. But what God's saying is there's a quality to a mother's love that actually is destructible. Not because there's anything wrong with the love, but just because human beings aren't indestructible. But God's point is, I'm indestructible. My love for you can never be destroyed. I will never forget you. That's what we need when we're in our chapter ones. A knowledge that the father would compare himself to a nursing mother and say, look at that. But it's limited and it's finite. You just got to notch it up one, because I'm limitless and I'm infinite and I am at a far greater scale. Though your mother may forget you, I will never forget you. My love for you, everything within me, physically, my very being, my glory, my faithfulness, my character, everything within me moves me towards you. My emotional nature moves me towards you. When you see a mother doting over a little baby, even when the baby's asleep and it's just like fixed, it's doting on a baby, God would say, let that just be a very dim hint of my everlasting delight in you. I will never forget you. Never. That's got to put a big question in us. We've got to ask, when a love of such magnitude from a person of such magnitude becomes an abiding reality in our hearts, not a doctrinal belief, but an abiding reality in our hearts, we got to realize that that's the thing that lifts us above our circumstance. That's when we're in our chapter one that we can find something of a joy that springs within the very foundation of our lives. And no circumstance, no tragedy, no difficulty, no past hurt, no insecurity, no sin can put a cork in that fountain. That's what my friend at the back had. You want to talk about circumstance, tragedy, facing difficulty, but somehow there was a fountain within him. And God says, you got to understand my love for you, even in the moments of a chapter one. When the chapter four seems far away, you got to know in that moment, my love for you is of such a nature that I will never, ever forget you. You might feel forsaken, you might feel forgotten, but I am right there with you like a nursing mother. But I take it to a whole new level because I'm unlimited in my love for you. And then he takes it even further because we hear this despondent cry in verse 14. I feel forsaken, I feel forgotten. And he responds, God responds by this incredible expression of his love for us. But the reality is he's still talking. And God knows love is not just a matter of words. Love is deed. Love is action. And so he says, see, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. Your walls are ever before me. God goes from talking to action. You know, a mother would be willing. She would be prepared to move heaven and earth for her child to flourish. She would stop at nothing. God says, I'm like that. I'd stop at nothing. And not only am I prepared to move heaven and earth, I have moved heaven and earth. In fact, I've moved from heaven to earth because everything within me moves me towards you. You want to know how much I love you? I love you that much that I would move from heaven to earth and I would lay down my life for you. Because my love for you is undeniable, unquestionable. I love this picture of being engraved in the palm of the hands. In those days, what would happen is when you had masters and servants, what would often happen is they would tattoo the name of the master onto the servant's hands. But never, never would they tattoo the name of the servant on the master's hands. Because that tattoo was something of like a devotion. So the servant, I'm devoted to the master. That's why the master would never have the servant's name tattooed on his hand. Because that would mean I'm devoted to the servant. And yet God says of us, but not tattoo, engraved. That word in the Hebrew is an engraving that comes with a hammer and a chisel. Or a hammer and a spike. He says, I've engraved you in the palm of my hand. And that condition of the heart that Naomi was suffering with and that Zion was suffering with, we see come through for Thomas as well. Because in that weekend, it is absolute chaos. Everything within him, he is full of doubt, full of anxiety. He is fearing his life. All of what we were hoping, I put all of my eggs in this basket, and he's now dead. What am I going to do? They're out to kill us. He is facing all the tragedy and the circumstance that you could potentially dream of, and he is fearing for his life. And he knows all of what Jesus had to say. He knows about all the prophetic utterances and the promises of salvation. he knows all the history. And he's got the disciples bopping around him saying, he's risen, he's risen. And he's like, I don't buy it. I feel like he's forsaken us. I feel like he's forgotten us. He's dead. And it would take a moment where Jesus would appear to him and he would say, Thomas, look at the palms of my hands. I have engraved you in the palms of my hands. I will never forsake you. I was forsaken so that you would never, ever be forsaken. Can a mother forget? I will never forget you. See how I love you. This is my love for you, that I would lay down my life for you. And with a hammer and a spike, you would be carved and engraved into my very hands. That's my love for you, Thomas. And that's the only thing that could change it for him. I think when we think of our kids, parenting is this hard thing, you know? Because it's like you invest and you give and you sacrifice, and it's one way. You give, they take. And just when you're coming to the terms of that, you realize at an age when they begin to speak and they're able to express themselves, there's a new frustration waiting. And that is that they have completely missed your sacrifice. It's gone unnoticed. As far as they're concerned, that's what parents are for. You meet my every need. That's why God made you. But when that gets T-boned with a, Daddy, I want this. Or Mommy, I want this, sweetie. And you say no. For something that small, you get bursts, outbursts. And whether it's explicit or it's implicit, what's coming out is, you don't love me. And in that moment, you just want to, do you know what sacrifice I have made for you? Do you understand the reality of what I have invested into your life? If you did, you would understand that the most crucial needs, the things that really matter, is where my sacrifice, I have given you those things. And it's not the thing you're asking for right now. And I think it's the same with us and God. Where we say, do you see my now? Do you see my chapter one? I feel like you've forgotten me because actually I need you to answer my prayers in this regard. I need you to sort my finances out. I need you to change that relationship. I need you to fix the emotions that are within me because I'm bitter and I'm offended and I'm insecure and all of these realities keep coming at me. But you're not. I feel like you've forgotten me. Like a four-year-old in the aisles of Toys R Us. And I feel like God would say, can you just for one second take your eyes off your circumstance and see the magnitude of my sacrifice for you? Because when you do, and when you allow me to minister into your heart, that it's not just here in your head, but when it dives deep into your heart, that abiding reality of just how much I love you, that I would meet every crucial need. I'm speaking about matters of forgiveness here. That your slate has been wiped clean. I have dealt with it. You are mine. I've made you my child. And there is a future eternal destiny where you and I are going to be together for all eternity. So what you're asking for right now is not the crucial thing. I understand what you're going through. I realize that life is full of chapter ones. But actually, something of that chapter one allows you to see the reality. But you need to lift your eyes above your circumstance and see that I have engraved you in the palms of my hands. That's the sacrifice. that counts. That's the need that's been met. And when you lift your eyes above the reality of life and all your circumstances, you're still going through your chapter one. But you can, like my friend at the back, worship me with all your heart because something of a fountain of joy is bursting within you. And I want to ask that this morning, we ask God for that. In each of our hearts, we're going to take up communion, and I'm going to ask Adele if you could just come up and just minister in song. Whether you want to sing with or not, doesn't really matter, but it's your opportunity to just take the emblems. Just say, Lord Jesus, your body that was broken for me, your blood that was shed for me, the fact that I've been engraved in the palms of your hands, that you will never forsake me, that you will never, ever forget me. I want you to take that reality that I potentially believe, but somehow my sensing of it is just, it's clouded at the moment because it's darkened by the reality of my circumstances and the things that I'm facing. Can we ask God to minister to our hearts that this thing that we know, but we're not sensing, can become an abiding reality in our hearts that takes us way above whatever life dishes out. That we're not just celebrating Easter this weekend, but we know, heck, on Monday things are going to go back to normal. It's Easter every day. The reality of what Jesus has done. And let's let it lift us. Allow God to minister to us in such a way that we don't live under the darknesses of our circumstance and the yeah, but I feel forgotten. He will never, ever forget you. His love is unconditional. His love is indestructible. And his love has been demonstrated to us by him moving from heaven to earth and dying for us. Let's stand together just in your own time. Take the emblems. Pray to God. Ask him, Lord, make this an abiding reality in my heart.